Hello and welcome back to See You Out There podcast, the podcast where two unqualified football fans try to sound qualified to talk about football. We're eventually back. We're back in the game. So are most of the Premier League teams after a lovely FA Cup weekend, would you say? Or week? Or how would you put it? I don't really know. The FA Cup spans across a couple of days, right?
Yeah, like it's FA Cup third round. Wasn't there like something like 32 games across the footballing pyramid?
Jesus.
In the FA Cup alone. So, yeah, fair juice.
But Premier League is back. Normal service resumed. I feel like we're really back after the World Cup now. I feel like the World Cup sort of has faded into the background and we're back into the real stuff now. But someone else who is very much real and very much here is my wonderful co-host, Sean. Shawnee, how are you doing?
Good. Well rested after the Christmas break. Apologies for any delayed podcasts. Promises may or may not have been made pre-Christmas, but sure, look, you know how it goes. But we're back, New Year's resolutions and that, get this podcast
need that rest.
Regular
it's a
again.
Long second, need that rest because it's a long second half of the season. Long one. So, yeah, but who will we kick off with then?
Yes, so just I think intro of the section or this week's pod is that we're going to just, I think we might have done similar pre-Christmas, but a lot's happened between now and then. And the stories about sort of your Brightons and such will crop up continuously throughout the season and how they're doing. But I think we'll start with just sort of, I suppose, the traditional big six, because I think that's where a lot of the interesting talking points are happening at the minute. So in that vein, beginning with La Arsenal, Owen's beloved, two wins and a draw since the return in the Premier League and then casually swatting aside Oxford last night. All going well. Eddie and Ketch doesn't seem to be missing too much of a step compared to Jesus in terms of missing chances and scoring one or two nice ones. So, yeah, it seems like it's all resumed like Arsenal pre-Christmas.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would actually stand on the side of saying that Eddie Nketiah is a better finisher than Gabriel Jesus. His record has been quite good since coming into the team, but it was at the end of last season as well. And I mean, that's why Arsenal signed him on that big bumper contract. Mikel Arteta had the faith that he could do the business if called upon. I mean, we're at a stage now where we're pretty much in the middle of January. Gabriel Jesus has got his cast off. He's off crutches. So hopefully it's not too long until Gabriel Jesus is back in the fold as well. Perhaps some bodies coming in soon. Reports in Ukraine are suggesting that Mykhailo Mudryk is edging closer. Obviously, you can take that with a pinch of salt until you see him in the actual shirt itself. But ultimately, things are looking good. Yeah, I mean, sort of circling back to sort of what we were talking about. I mean, one draw against Newcastle. It's probably the best I've seen a team defend at the Emirates for quite some time. I think Newcastle really, like, I mean, not to say it's my first time examining them closely this season, but obviously I examine them a little bit closer when they're playing my team. And I was just like, oh, this is why they're getting so many points. It's so, the way they play is so clever. And it's the thing that we've been saying about them consistently. I mean, we're not really talking about Newcastle, we're talking about Arsenal right now, but like, you know, they did a great job. They did a really great job of shutting Arsenal down. I mean, Arsenal's power really comes through the flanks, unlocked by the midfield. Arsenal were the better side in the game, sure. It's one of those ones where you just wish you had an extra 10 or 15 minutes with tired legs on one side. But, you know, Eddie Howe's put together a nice thing there. So I'm not too... ultimately, what I'm saying is I'm not too bothered by the draw against Newcastle. I think, you know... we've only dropped points three times this season, once against Newcastle, once against Southampton, which was very disappointing, and then of course against Manchester United earlier on. Title race is still on, they're still there. Yeah, no worries until there are worries. Spurs this weekend, so that'll be interesting. But yeah, what do you think about Arsenal at the moment?
I think Arsenal's like the epitome of kind of what we're going to say about a lot of teams. It feels like since coming back from the World Cup and everything else, not much has changed. Like every team is performing similarly to how they were. Arsenal are kind of still dominating and still playing really well. You know, Newcastle, you know, and we'll probably touch on this a few times throughout the podcast, but as I jokingly mentioned, but they haven't really missed a step switching from Jesus to Nketiah. Now, that goal he scored against West Ham was lovely. I thought that was a really nice finish from him and a nice bit of skill. So good to see he is starting to play his way into a bit of form, hopefully, which will be needed. Like, I'm struggling to see ways that this Arsenal team falter, to be honest, between now and end of the season, because it's nearly halfway and they've come through every test. They got themselves knocked out of the Carabao Cup nice and early, to be honest. I don't think that's any bad thing, considering what's in front of them is more important in terms of a league title, perhaps, and Europe, albeit Europa League. But, and of course, they're still in the FA Cup, but I don't think that's going to be as massively important to them, considering they won it recently and, as I say, what's in front of them. So the only things I can see potentially halting them is if they don't get the bodies in to supplement, you know, if Saka's out for a while, are we going to see, like, if you end up, sorry, more so with Nketiah and not Nicola Pepe, but like Smith Rowe, for example, instead of Saka and Jesus, I'd say for a prolonged period that might actually drop the quality a fair amount, considering the form the two latter former players were in. So yeah, that's the only thing I can see going wrong for them, and maybe the workload and maybe some of the fragility of mentality creeping in. But you know, Arsenal have kind of come through periods like this before. They seem to have the mentality to maintain this. So it's kind of odd. If the ball's in City's court, really, to put the pressure on them and see if they crack. And to do that, City need to put together a pretty formidable run of form, and they haven't quite done that yet.
I also think that game between Arsenal and City in February is very, very important. You know, but you mentioned a name there, and it's actually one that I was going to bring up myself. Emile Smith Rowe returning to action last night for Arsenal, and I think he's a player who, you know, the old adage goes, like a new signing, coming back into the team, because Emile Smith Rowe obviously hasn't been a part of this Arsenal journey so far at all, really, since the season started. A guy who could possibly be credited with saving Mikel Arteta's job, which sounds bizarre to say now, but I mean, when he came into the team alongside some comrades against Chelsea that fateful December, that's ultimately what saved Mikel Arteta's job. Emile Smith Rowe is a player that can do things that other Arsenal players can't, which is exactly what you need when you're trying to push for a title, right? Because ball at his feet, I think he might be the best player at the club with the ball at his feet. He is the best runner with the ball, I think. And I don't think that's any surprise. He's really two-footed. He can drive through two, three different players, draw fouls, do things. Like, I mean, a lot of the Arsenal players can draw fouls pretty well, but Emile Smith Rowe driving through the centre gives us a different element. I think that he's obviously not going to come in and start, but ultimately having him off the bench makes things a little bit stronger, and hopefully getting in a wide player as well. I'm just really, really happy to see him back, and I think he'll make a massive difference in those games where we need to give somebody a rest.
Yeah, I'd ball at feet, I don't know. From an outsider's perspective, I would have assumed that was a Saka, or, you know, like, I know you're closer to the team and watch them more regularly, but, like, Smith Rowe's a great player and he's very direct, but, and he will give you something a bit different, but I suppose the one key, I don't know, from an outsider's looking in, he hasn't had the time because of injury, really, to maybe, as I would say, step up to the next level, like I think Saka has in the same period, because Smith Rowe's had a pretty injury interrupted time in the last 6 months. So now it's his chance, to come into the team and make an impression. So
yeah,
in terms of, I think we touched on it pre-Christmas, but you know, all the talk about Mudrick and stuff coming out, is there anything else of note, you think, that may come in? I saw 100 million for Mudrick and I couldn't quite believe it. That seemed like
it's
a false tabloid article. Yeah,
I think anybody who knows anything about Arsenal at the moment, this current guise of Arsenal with Edu Gaspar, Mikel Arteta, Vina Venkatesham and the Cronkies in full control, knows that they're not going to do that. Perhaps, like, you know, all sorts of wild, wacky add-ons. I do have to shift the blame to your club a little bit for this problem that clubs are having. because it's been quoted by David Ornstein and Fabrizio Romano that they keep pointing to the Anthony price tag. And I'm like, yeah. But eventually one party's going to fold, right? Because either Shakhtar are going to realize they're not going to get the money, or Arsenal are going to realize they're not going to get the player. So I think the problem in all of this, and we'll touch on them later on in the podcast, is Chelsea, because you never know what they're going to do. They might be like, sure, we'll pay it. Why not? But yeah. But I think Mudryk is the only one of substance. I mean, Wilfred Zaha was essentially ruled out. João Felix is now going to Chelsea. So I don't see a forward player, perhaps a midfield player coming in. But we know about Arsenal now, they're not gonna panic buy. For better or for worse, you know.
The just to jump in there on, I think Arsenal, you know, that fateful summer of 2021 where Gary Neville slagged off the recruitment policy of Arsenal, you know, getting Benjamin White for 50 million, Ramsdale for 30, X, Y, and Z. You know, it's come off cropper for them, as we can all see. So they've done really well. I think they've really got a strategy. And the only thing I couldn't predict for Arsenal, sorry, not even predict, but could foresee in some sense, is that you might see someone who's potentially a summer target get brought forward. And maybe it's not someone we know fully about yet, not because Mudryk was kind of mentioned even towards the late stage of the summer window. So it seems like he's been a long-term target. So a target they have for the summer might be brought forward because they go, you know what, we actually have to, this is our chance and let's invest now. So let's bring forward a target, as I say. So that's the only thing I can think of that Arsenal might do in the January window. But I don't even know if they really need it, because I wonder about squad depth, but they just seem to be managing quite well. I suppose if, as I say, a few key injuries like together, that's what really might scupper the charge. But it's yet to happen and may not even happen. So they're scarily getting closer and closer each week. On.
Yeah, I mean, look, we have to see. It's still like we still aren't even halfway through the season yet. So we've still got a long way to go. Positive sounds though coming out of Arsenal in general, and you know, all faith in the manager. You know, it's at the stage now where it's like, okay, this isn't impossible, so let's keep going until it is. And look, at the end of the day, look, it's going to be a disappointment if it doesn't happen, because I think it's crept into everyone's mind at this point. But at the same time, you know, goals and expectations will shift accordingly, and the good thing about this Arsenal team, and hopefully Mikel Arteta, is I don't think they're going to go away. I don't think this is a one season wonder. I think the trajectory has been constantly been going up, fluctuated a couple times during his tenure, but I think it's at a stage now where Arsenal are going to be a top team in Europe, hopefully for the next couple of years, which is great news. But if I just, before we move off Arsenal, just their next few fixtures are Tottenham away, Man United at home, then City away in the FA Cup, Everton away, Brentford at home, and then City at home in the Premier League. So some pretty tight and tough fixtures. The good news is, and I mean, this is speaking from an Arsenal perspective, is you would look at those next two games and think, right, if we can get the job done in those two games, then we can wrap up Champions League. We can be fairly sound in the knowledge that we're not going to blow that from that distance, which is quite nice. But I mean, you know, it's not at the stage where we can expect to win every game, but we can at least expect to have a chance of winning every game. So I think, you know, Arsenal have to go into those games confident. And their games, essentially every game now is a game Arsenal have to win. So we will see how that goes. But we should really roll on from the Gunners and talk about their title adversaries, Manchester City. Thoughts on City's return to the Prem?
Not convinced, to be honest. You know, they've come off back-to-back wins against Chelsea in League and Cup, but they did get that draw against Everton. And what was the other win they had against? Oh, but it wasn't fully convincing. Anyways, this last period since coming back is, the City identity, even the one they had just before Christmas, like, seems to be gone a bit. Like, Cancelo's out of the team, Haaland's scoring, but, you know, he's only scored 3 and 3, you know, like, by his standards, that's pretty low. They looked far more on fire against Chelsea in the cup than they did in the first half. You know, that was quite a scrappy league game between the two. So I think there's a bit of flux there in terms of the tactical identity of the team. Like, you of course have to play Haaland because his goal scoring numbers are outstanding, and I think Grealish has actually looked pretty good since coming back too. But because of how well they played against Chelsea with, you know, sort of the City side of last year with Alvarez up top and a more eights on the pitch and more nearly attacking midfield style players, you know, in Pep's dream world, like, they seem so much better. So is he going to start reverting to that? Is Haaland going to get benched a little bit more than we expect? You know, he's kind of playing every game. If it's 3 games in the space of 8 days, Haaland's played every one of them. So maybe now we'll see more rotation for Haaland because Pep wants to be playing his, you know, because I think Haaland's struggling a little bit. Like, this is ridiculous because it's Haaland, but, like, he's not scoring as freely because teams are sitting deeper against them and there's less space for him to run into behind to. And the, you know, your man Lewis has come in for Cancelo and he's doing a really good job. He's also keeping Cancelo out of the team, but he's also not doing it half as well as a good Cancelo would. So, stuff to be figured out at City. And, you know, you call them adversaries, but I was expecting them to come back on all the cylinders blasting. And they've come back and they haven't really, which makes me wonder, are they, because they're 7 points adrift. They're going to have to put together, like, a good chunk of form. Like, they're going to have to win a lot of games in a row to surmount that lead initially and then continue it, because I'm sure Arsenal will do similar. So there's pressure on them as well as Arsenal.
Well, I will say they are only 5 points adrift. So not quite 7, oh, like it was.
My mistake.
But but yeah, I mean, I don't want to put too much juju on it because I don't know. But I'm also not really convinced. And where it comes from me is the back line. I just see them as... And maybe, I don't know if this actually exists, but because it certainly never happened to Manchester United, and as far as I can remember. But do they have, like, title fatigue? Do you know what I mean? I remember I was watching the Chelsea game, and after the game, and Haaland is going mental after the game. He's delighted that Chelsea, even though he didn't score, but he's delighted that they've beaten Chelsea and they've got those 3 points. And there's a couple of bodies kind of just strolling off. Like, it seemed like the newer players were more enthusiastic, because obviously they've never won the Premier League before. But it seems like, I wonder, do they have a lot of bodies who this is just routine for them? And is it a bit of specialization going on where they're just like, you know, maybe the Champions League is at the forefront of their minds, and maybe the manager and the staff's minds as well. I mean, like, what is another title to Man City? You know what I mean? Does it mean a lot really to them? I mean, I'm not questioning the professionalism of Manchester City's players, but what I'm saying is, I wonder, after like 5 titles for the likes of a Kyle Walker, does your attention shift? You know, are the goals of each Manchester City player aligned with the rest of the team? Is everybody driving towards the same thing? I don't know. Maybe they are. And listen, they're 5 points off the top of the Premier League. They're hardly slouches. But I wonder, is that small margin the difference, perhaps? But yeah, it's just a thought, really. I do think they are going to come on strong in the Champions League. I think they will endeavour to destroy everyone in their path with Haaland in the Champions League when they can. Because, I mean, yeah, sure, you can play a low block and you can trudge along and you can pick up your points in the Premier League, but I don't know if anyone can really stop them in the Champions League. You'd have to have a pitch perfect 2 legs to beat Manchester City in the Champions League this year. So
unless you're Real Madrid, you know, you only need 20 minutes.
Unless you're Real Madrid. But yeah, listen, the one name that Man City don't want to see is Real Madrid on that thing. Real Madrid have the juju.
I feel like the one name they don't want to see is like Benfica in the quarterfinals, where Pep does that thing where he gets tactically weird, and then suddenly
Haaland should be
what should be a straightforward win becomes a Benfica surprise shock win, you know, like, so
nobody understands goals more than Haaland, so he's going to be our keeper today.
Yeah, exactly. He's, you know, we needed his presence in between the sticks. But yeah, like, I don't think there's a whole lot else to talk about with City, to be honest, because like, we know what they're good at, we know what they can do, they've done it many times. I think if there is a mentality issue on in terms of them all pulling towards the same goal, then that comes down to the manager to unite them and to make sure that they're 100% towards that goal. And, you know, Haaland is notoriously a big character in a dressing room. Like, having watched him with Dortmund, he's always been a bit of a mentality monster, as they say. So I'm sure he'll start getting into lads if it's not going well. And I think having him as a personality as much as a goal scorer might drive City on a bit more to get their shit together, because they kind of have to now, you know. I know we're not even halfway, but they went to the World Cup with a loss. They've come back with a draw and some iffy performances. They can't afford to have much more of those.
Well, if I may, like, going back to fixtures again. So we know that Arsenal are playing Man City at home on the 15th of February at 8:30. So it's an evening game. It's going to be a very, very loud Emirates Stadium. But the reality is that that game is only a handful of games away. The title picture will not be different by the time that game rolls around. So essentially, that is the one that I think both Man City and Arsenal will have their eyes on. I mean, if Arsenal can maintain a bit of touching distance and then beat Man City or even hold them, that's a pretty good result for Arsenal. If City can catch up in the meantime, with a little help from perhaps United or Spurs or et al., then City can maybe take the driver's seat of the title race in that game. So it's really, like, interesting. I think we're going to really see in February, do City have the medal to really take hold of this title race and drive forward like they usually do in the second half of the season. Just before we leave City, do you still think City are going to win the league?
I don't know. I don't know which way. I think it's a coin flip at this stage, to be honest. That, like, Arsenal have a 5-point lead, and, you know, that still makes me go, I'd probably be 55% in favour of City, is the way I'd be at the minute.
That's a good way to put it. There's a nagging feeling that I can't escape, that, you know, having watched Man City for the last couple of years, that they're just going to do it again. Obviously, that would require Arsenal to drop points either to them or elsewhere, which is a bit of a harder thing to swallow, but I just can't avoid it in my brain that City are going to win the league this year. And again, like I said, I think the only way that my mind is going to change is after that game in February, when I know what's happened there. Because even if that game was tomorrow, City could draw themselves within 2 points, you know, or Arsenal could extend their lead to 8. Which is a massive difference. The good old fashioned English top tier division 6-pointer, eh? But we should move on once more to the red neighbours. Your side of the fence, my friend. Manchester United, they're going well. They're going very bloody well.
And they're about to decide the title, I think. You know, they're playing Man City and Arsenal back to back in the league. Oh no, sorry, there's Palace wedged in between there.
If I can request one... If I can request one W from Man U, you've already beaten Arsenal this season. There's nothing to prove. You've already beaten City as well, haven't you? Damn it.
No. We got hockey by City.
Yeah, that's right. Sorry. But if you could, you hockeyed Spurs, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, played them off park. It was 2-0, but yeah.
Yeah. But I remember watching that game being like, wow. But yeah, if you could win one of those games, just as a courtesy... as a courtesy for the dodgy VAR decision in the Old Trafford leg of the game, I think you guys should beat City.
Just for the fact you mentioned the dodgy VAR call, I hope and pray that they smash Arsenal and like destroy any shred. I'm not wishing them to lose against Man City, but I hope they really like just stick one into, like, you know, look, let's talk the talk. On Man United are 9 points off the league table, top of the title. You know, if they win against these two lads, they go within probably the 3 points of the league, you know, with Palace in between.
Miracle run.
Yeah, it would be shocking. Now, all right, let's get real here. Because that doesn't do me well to be big and boisterous about these things as a long-suffering United fan of the last few years, but things are looking good, do you know? And nobody's really talking about Man United, I think, in a good way, in terms of Ten Hag seems to be making a lot of good decisions. Harry Maguire came back into the team for a little bit and the world didn't, you know, collapse in on itself. We're getting in big vout, hopefully, which seems a bit odd in some respects, but it does kind of look
I think it's a great signing.
Yeah, it looks pretty sensible to me, to be honest. You know, given the two, like, obviously it's not based on World Cup performance alone, but 9 and 18 for Beşiktaş, his form at Wolfsburg before going to Burnley, his pressing numbers even when he was at Wolfsburg, so, and the fact Ten Hag wants him, and it seems pretty cheap and only a 6 month kind of, we need backup in that department since Ronaldo left, so.
Also, but in a world where results are king at this stage of Ten Hag's tenure, I mean, I know he's trying to, like, you know, results don't really matter that much to him, I'm sure, because he's trying to instill a new style of play and a new culture, but in terms of the optics from the outside and maybe qualifying for the Champions League, results are king, and you've got a guy in Wout Weghorst. I mean, I saw him over here when the Netherlands played Poland, and he just comes on, he's a havoc player. He presses from the front. He's there for a set piece. You're always worried about him for a set piece. You know what I mean? If with him in the team, there will not be a single time where a team will be able to relax on a set piece. And that's something. So, you know what I mean? I think it's a results positive signing for Man United if it comes through. So, kudos.
Yeah. And, you know, like, they've been on a great run of form. 4 wins in a row in the league. Obviously, one of those being against Fulham. They've navigated the FA Cup and Carabao Cup draws really well. And I think United are kind of this season showing that they probably have Champions League level of quality and form right now. If they maintain this throughout the season, they'll beat teams they should beat. They'll get enough points to get to qualify to the Champions League. There might be the odd loss like that one against Aston Villa. They might get torched this coming Saturday against Man City again. Arsenal might do them in, but I think in terms of where they're at as a team, it's really starting to click and come together. They're dominating possession and maintaining pressure against the likes of Bournemouth that I haven't seen them do in a while. Like, I'd be watching United games nearly behind a cushion sometimes, because even if they were winning, as we saw with the Gea's howler against Everton on Friday, that seemed to happen. There was a lot of calamity at the back in a lot of instances, even when all was meant to be going swimmingly. So Ten Hag's really instilling a sort of on the pitch and off the pitch just endurance to do and play football well and do all the right things. You know, that whole Rashford thing with him being benched for being late for a meeting, like, having that discipline is good for the team, and Rashford seems to benefit massively because he's on track to have his best season ever for Man United. So, but I think the key for United this season is, obviously, if they just keep up this form, they'll stay in the Champions League spots. But they're well positioned in the cups. Like, let's be honest. You know, you've Arsenal and Man City are going to knock each one of them are going to knock each other out early in the FA Cup. United have drawn Reading. They had Everton previous to this. They're playing Charlton tonight in the Carabao Cup. Like, it seems Ten Hag is taking them very seriously, and I think he should. You know, getting any sort of trophy in the first season, like with Arteta, will really just add value to him as the manager, especially if he delivers. And also, like, Europa League, you know, big game against Barcelona coming up as well. So, like, if he can maintain the cups and just keep Champions League positions, I think United fans will be delighted with this first season.
I think there's a tendency with us fans as well to be like, oh, you should be resting this player in this cup game, and you should be doing this for this cup game, and cups, like, you know, rest this guy, do this, do that, like, early stages, whatever. And sure, there's an element to that, but also, like, you know, we have to remember as armchair citizens in the football world that most of these footballers want to play every single game. Like, I don't know if the team has come out for the United game yet, but I presume that it's strong enough against Charlton, or will be. And, you know, if you're a guy like Marcus Rashford, you want to be in that team tonight. You know what I mean? I think a lot of those players want to be in that team. I think Harry Maguire want to be in that team and be like, yeah, no, look, I can, every time you put me out on the pitch, I'm going to do it for you. So, and I think, like you said, that mentality, you know, you look at, you can compare the Rashford situations in slight to Aubameyang, not even the most recent stuff, but when he was dropped for the Spurs game for being stuck in traffic that time. And it's like, you're really dropping our best player for our most important game? And Arteta was like, yeah, I am. And it sets a standard. And it's like, I'm not comparing Rashford to Aubameyang, because by all accounts, Rashford is a better character than Aubameyang. But at the same time, you've got a guy like Marcus Rashford, who is incredibly important, who is almost, I think, if I close my eyes, the first face I think of when I think of United now. And, you know, so essentially being Mr. Manchester United, and it's like, no one's safe. Doesn't matter if you're a nice lad, you mess up, you're out. And that sort of culture that Ten Hag is instilling and will instill is only going to make Man United stronger. But yeah, I think, like you said, a cup could be really, really important. My only question to you, and I think this is one that's come up a couple of times over our long and illustrious tenure, is what to do about the right wing position. What do you make of the right wing position at Man United? Because it's one that confuses me to no end when I watch Man United. It's the only thing that confuses me, actually, because I think everything else is quite good and quite brilliant.
Well, arguably, United have spent 170-odd million in the last 3 years to sort out the right wing position, and it's still not sorted. Now, I don't think that's entirely fair on both Sancho and Anthony. I'm not really 100% sure what's going on with Sancho, but I think it's mental as much as anything else after what happened last year between the Euros and the United season.
Yeah, I'm not trying to rag on, and again, I'm not trying to rag on Sancho and Anthony here. I'm just kind of a little bit like, it just seems, it sticks out, right? Am I wrong to say that? But to me, as a neutral viewer.
You're spot on. Like, but to be honest, I'm kind of thinking this is nearly like good problems in a sense, because United are still winning games pretty comfortably despite all of this. And like, Anthony's still scoring goals, do you know? Like, he's not playing particularly well. And like, he's only 21, and I think, to be honest, the problem is that he's an 100 million euro winger, which he was never meant to be. I think he could stomach it at 60, given how the market is now, which I think was the initial quoted price before United got dragged into trying to buy half of that Ajax team. But I think a lot of it's explained by the fact that, you know, Anthony's obviously very left-footed and he's not willing to use his right, and he's always trying to show on the inside at the minute. And I think it's a case of he needs coaching, and with so many games so often, it's a bit of a struggle to get them. He's also was missing just before the World Cup, when this United team really started to kind of gel. So I think he's just trying to find his way into that membrane. And thirdly, I think Dalot is massively important. Wan-Bissaka's been doing fine, but to allow your winger to do, especially when it's Anthony or Sancho, the style of players they are, they require Dalot to do a lot of overlapping to like drag defenders out of the way. And, you know, I don't think that's quite been happening with Wan-Bissaka, and Dalot's been not fully fit just yet. Like, he's getting back up to match sharpness. So I just think this whole situation needs time. Anthony is, you know, he's the chosen guy, it seems, for 100 million. Sancho, we don't know what's going to happen with him. You know, Rashford is the left winger. That's his best position. But I just think it's a bit unfair. Like, Anthony is like 5 goals or something. That's pretty good return in his first season, given the amount of games he's played. So he has a lot to work on, you know, but signs are there. And the one thing I'll say in his favour is that he seems to be a bit of a dog, you know, like he has bite to him. What I like most about him is how I've seen him track back with aggression. And I think that's going to be massively important come Saturday, and against Arsenal as well. So I think he's 21. The only way is kind of up in a lot of senses. And when Ten Hag gets some time to really coach him, I think we'll see. Because Ten Hag clearly has an idea of what he wants from him.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think he wouldn't have gotten him otherwise, right? I guess, you know, one thing And obviously, this is wishful thinking, especially when you have a player out on loan. I mean, you know, cast my mind out to Follorín Balogun being one of the highest scorers in Ligue 1 right now. But one thing that keeps on creeping up for me, even as someone who isn't a Man United supporter, is how well Amad Diallo is doing in the Championship. And I know he's not someone who can come into the Man United team right now. And obviously, if he did, he'd be third choice, if not more. But do you think that's something that Ten Hag might have in the back of his head, is incorporating some of these? Like, obviously, he's probably not even going to be a starter next season. But do you think that's something that's in the future for Man United, and in the back of his head is like these sort of like not academy prospects, but these younger players, and sort of growing the squad outward, sort of similar to Arsenal with the likes of, like, you know, like a Fabio Vieira, a couple of those younger players, sort of bringing them in, not as starters, but to sort of supplement and try and grow them to a level where they can possibly compete for places. Do you think he's a guy who might? Because this is the only thing that's come to my attention in the last like month or two. Do you think he's a guy who possibly has a future at Manchester United?
Well, just on this point, I think one thing Ten Hag is definitely going to have to work on. It's not an immediate thing, but it's kind of like to succeed as a Manchester United manager, I think, is a lot of what's gone on in terms of recruitment and player decisions have been largely driven by him. And, you know, all of these loan players, like Ahmad, signed for 37 million before Ten Hag signed. So he's going to have to learn to embed into the structure where they maybe suggest a player who isn't Dutch or from the Eredivisie. Do you know what I mean? So with Ahmad, it's hard to know. And I think what United are doing a lot better this year than they have done in a lot of previous years is there's some really successful loans going on at the same time. So you've got Ahmad doing well at Sunderland. Fernandez is playing really well at fullback for Preston North End. Ethan Laird's doing pretty well at right back. And then Hannibal Medjri's playing week in, week out for Birmingham. So I think United just need to basically, it's one of two options. You know, sell these players, build these players' value up so that they can actually be sold, which they haven't really done successfully because they need to figure out how to be a more sustainably run club. But Ahmad, when he first debuted for United, showed signs, and I didn't think he had the build or the skill set to really make it, to be honest. He's quite small. But given he's doing so well in the hurly-burly Championship, and also the fact that he's a very similar build and style of player to Anthony, I think him coming back next year might really provide competition in a way that they don't have, because the only other option instead of Anthony is like Alanga, who's just a really like a runner. You know what I mean? Like, he loves running behind and he's full of energy. Whereas Ahmad maybe provides that little bit of skill and incision. So I think next year he might be a bit of a push on Anthony. But yeah, look, it's going well for the first time in a long time. So for sure. We'll see.
I'm also saying, like, you know, that's sort of a sort of extra flowers, isn't it? When your team is doing really well and then you look and like your lone players who aren't even with the squad are doing well as well. So like, you know, I would say the only way is up, but that's not really the case. But I mean, it's all up for United at the minute. And also, he'll be making his TV debut, I'm sure, in the new season of Sunderland Till I Die. So looking forward to that when that comes along. I mean, Sunderland maybe into the playoff places at some point this year, which would be really fun. But moving on from Manchester United, we come to Spurs. I think I've proudly said at a number of occasions that I think it's going to explode at Spurs, or implode, or whatever way you want to put it. I don't think Antonio Conte is going to stick around. And that narrative seems to be growing stronger outside of my bubble. So, what do you make of Spurs? What's the deal there? Because, I don't know, like, I just think they're a little bit rubbish, but the sort of old Spurs thing of they've got quality, so they will win games. You know, when you've got a player like Kane and a player like Son, you are going to win games. But I don't know, where do they go from here? Are they going to be in the Champions League? I don't know.
We said it so many times, and the same thing, it's the same as again, not much has changed since Christmas, you know, or since what it was before Christmas. Conte's just always venting and giving out in the press, and it's just, it's getting tiresome at this stage. Like, They're so stuttering. Do you know what I mean? Like, they haven't been consistent this season at all. And, you know, sorry, that's, you know, they've been the fifth most consistent side in the league, you know, because they are fifth, I suppose. But it, as you say, Owen, it does seem to be a lot down to not Son this season, let's be honest as well, because he's only scored 4 goals and he's only scored in 2 games, mind, you know, because 3 of those goals came as a substitute appearance off the bench. So I don't know. I feel like every time I see that Spurs team, there's a bit of too much chopping and changing in some ways. Like, it's Emerson Royale, then it's Doherty, then it's Sessegnon, then it's Perisic. And I feel like they should just maybe pick a first 11 and stick to it. And obviously that includes Kulusevski, but Kulusevski's injured. So it seems Brian Gill is filling in there now. So that's what I'd be doing if I was Conte. But he's not. And he's chopping and changing and going, I need more players, I need this, I need that. Woe is me. And it's kind of just like, just go out and play. And play from the start. Stop being so scared to step into a game from the beginning. It's all, as everyone says, Spurs only come alive in the second half. And I'm fairly sure there's stats that say, you know, if the Premier League was only based on second halves, Spurs would be top of the, or second in the league or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, they need this sort of hold out for the first half and then come alive with their fitness in the second. They keep going to the well too many times to get results like against Brentford and everything else. So, and we said all this before, so I don't think it's maybe going to implode, but I think Conte will see out his contract, which is only till the summer, and then Spurs are going to be left with a search for a new manager.
A giant Pochettino-shaped shadow appears over the toilet bowl in North London. But, yeah, look, I don't really think there's too much else to really say about Spurs, to be honest. Spurs are Spursy and will continue to be until the end of the season. I think they'll continue to nick wins. I think they'll keep nicking them. I think you want to have your eyes in the back of your head if you're a centre half and you're playing against Harry Kane the last 10 minutes of a game. But yeah, look, I think there's still a few twists and turns to come in this league. So like when we get, I think, you know, the title race is pretty much a lock in terms of those two teams. I would say at this point anyway. I think there's a better chance of it becoming a one horse race than a three. But then outside of that, I think the Champions League places are pretty saucy actually in terms of how close these teams are. And if any of these teams manage to come into form, you never know what could happen. One of these teams who is absolutely not in form though is Liverpool. Wow. Like, if you'd have told me this time last year that next year at this time Arsenal will be 16 points ahead of Liverpool, I'd have had you admit it executed actually for saying just such a ridiculous statement. But Liverpool find themselves in this position. What's going on? It doesn't look like any improvement's been made at all. What's the deal?
I don't even know. It's just a mess. Like, the fan base is at odds. Like, they're blaming Pep Linders for everything, apparently. And I was looking ahead at the fixture list there, and they play, like, Wolves, Newcastle, and a handful of other teams, and Everton. And I can't see confidently say Liverpool are going to win 5 games. You know what I mean? Like, looking at their next 5 fixtures. They just seem to have such a glass jaw or something. Do you know what I mean? Like, they look decent. Darwin Nunez gets into lots of goal-scoring opportunities and misses them. Salah's cropping up every now and then with his, you know, Salah's taken away so that when you actually look at his goal tally come the end of the season, it'll look pretty impressive again, I'd say. But it's just not clicking. And they're lucky to still be in the FA Cup. They're struggling in midfield in terms of bodies. Fabinho's had a massive drop-off in form. Like, Oxlade-Chamberlain started against West Ham. Was it West Ham? Against, in one of their games after Christmas as a left wing. Like, Oxlade-Chamberlain hasn't played consistently enough to really warrant starting position, but I suppose maybe options are limited. They've signed Cody Akpo. Is he really going to move the dial? I don't think so. You know, like, they need someone in midfield. And Matias Nunes was a name touted, but he's only just signed for Wolves. Is that really that realistic purchase in January? I don't know. I think, and Van Dijk's injured now for an extended period, which some might say is a blessing because he hasn't been in the best form himself. But I think it's kind of mentality at its core. I think Liverpool have just lost the drive they once had to play in that super energetic fashion. And
did
now
they miss
making
the boat, do you think, to revamp that team when they realized they were starting to lose touch with City? Was that the moment when they should have gone balls to the wall and maybe sold more players, brought in more players, tried to revamp this team?
Well, given that they're now up for sale, you'd wonder how willing the ownership were ever really to do that much investment. They kind of invested at a steady rate and quite a sensible rate, you would seem. But I think, you know, Liverpool's success has been built on the fact that the two big outlays they made in Van Dijk and Alisson turned out to be fantastic successes. And the rest of it was purchasing players for 30 odd million and building them up and, you know, all of that. It seems that they've now started putting out big outlays for the likes of Nunes and stuff, and they haven't worked out the same. And maybe Liverpool should have just gone for like a Cody Akpo in the summer, play Jota through the middle. You know, I know he got injured, but they seem to be moving away from their identity a little bit too much, and it's harming them. But they also just haven't renewed that midfield. They've lost Wijnaldum. They've lost, you know, Henderson's not the player he was. Fabinho's had him, like, Thiago's always injured. Like, they should have been buying central midfielders who can play that way. Like, the fact that Harvey Elliott started last season was probably the first warning sign as one of the midfield three as opposed to like an out-and-out attacker. So yeah, I don't think they've been sensible. And I think is it maybe because the owners currently aren't interested in investing altogether that much? They can get Cody Akpo for 30 odd million, which is a pretty good deal, you know, for a player with a lot of value. So they're willing to do that because that would probably help the value of the club moving forward. But yeah, I don't really know. We're talking about a Champions League race here. Like, the teams in the top four are the only ones who've been consistent in improving all season. You can't say for sure. I can't confidently tell you that Spurs and Liverpool are going to have their act together enough to challenge Newcastle and Man United right now. And I'm trying to be as unbiased as possible, but genuinely, Newcastle and Man United look so much more consistent than them.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with you. Like, I can't. I think you're right. I think Newcastle and Man United, in terms of form, in terms of everything, look so much stronger for those two positions. What I would say is, despite Liverpool not having their shit together, I still think that they have an abundance of quality in that team, even without Van Dijk. I think they need to go hell for leather. They need to cross their fingers and pray that Darwin Nunez can start putting them in the back of the net, because he's well able. I think we can see that. But yeah, looking at it here myself, I'm looking at, you know, United could possibly go 5 points clear of Spurs if they get their win in hand. So that would be a nice little cushion. And then you're talking about a Europa League race for the most part, unless things dramatically change. But for Liverpool, I think the main sort of thing is utilize the quality that they have, and just, I think they almost need to just go balls to the wall. They need to just start like going absolutely hell for leather, because it's what they're like. I mean, it's less the Klopp controlled sort of controlled annihilation that they used to do, but if they just maybe unshackle themselves a little bit, show a bit more expression. Cody Gakpo is really good in the final third, so maybe possibly he can unlock a little bit more. He's got good delivery as well. Maybe he can get more out of Nunez. Maybe they can insert themselves back into that race. It's not gone. It's not out of their reach yet. It's savable. So they just have to get their shit together. But speaking of savable, shall we talk about the last team, or do you have anything else on Liverpool?
No, let's move it on.
Savable to what I would call unsavable. My God. I'd be lying if I said I didn't enjoy seeing Chelsea in the state that they're in. I'm enjoying it a lot. You reap what you sow. It's fun. It's just, it brings a smile to my face. As much as I wish they beat City the other night, I don't know. I found Kepa just like measly falling to his knees and just letting that ball go past him a very good visual representation of Chelsea at the moment altogether. It just seems like nobody's willing to take responsibility or the blame for what's going on. Everybody's pointing fingers. There seems to be this hope or this line that's coming out internally or externally from Chelsea that, like, no, this is the plan. We're sticking with Potter. We're going to do all this stuff. It's just not working out, is it?
Well, it's not working out right now, right? But I don't think it's Potter's fault, if we're honest. Because...
Absolutely not. That's not what I'm trying to say either. I'm just saying that they're... That's the line that's coming out of Chelsea. It's like, no, we're fully committed to the manager. And it's like, well, hold on. This isn't just about the manager.
Yeah, no, absolutely. They've left their squad in absolute state. And the fact that they've left themselves starting both Thiago Silva and Koulibaly, who are both the wrong side of 33, like, that's a precarious position to be in. And it's noticeable that, Potter's turned to young centre-backs starting in the Cup, you know, and Hutchinson is playing more minutes, a guy I'd never heard of 2 weeks ago. You have a midfielder playing a left-back in Lewis Hall. Like, that Chelsea, you know, Chelsea have always been the team, other than City, who seem to have two first 11s, kind of. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of sheer expenditure, they seem to have a lot of quality, but now they have none of it. Rudiger, Christensen have walked out the door. Marcus Alonso's gone. Aspilicueta looks nothing like he used to, and he's not a right back anymore. So, for me, I feel bad for Potter because I think he's been left with a mess. Now, they've signed, well, how do you pronounce his name? Badiashile from Monaco.
Yeah, Badiashile, I think.
Badiashile, thank you. Which should help alleviate some of their defensive woes, I would say, but their midfield looks poor. Conor Gallagher looks like a lost man. Nothing like he did at Crystal Palace. They don't have a proper centre forward. You know, João Felix going to Chelsea is probably the weirdest choice, I think, of any of them.
Big Morata vibes for me.
But where's he fit? Because he's not a striker. And Chelsea kind of need a striker. You know, Datro Fofana has come in. But he's come from, is it Genk or Club Brugge or something? Like, he's not... That's a big step up. It's one thing stepping from that to Brighton, which was where I think he was originally intended to go.
On his, 10-year contract?
I know, it's mental. But, like, they just have problems all over the pitch, and it's not really Potter's fault that he's suffering all these injuries. Like, he's been left with a disastrous team, but he does need to kind of at least make them a bit solid, you know? Like, he just has to, because I was looking at the fixtures there, and Chelsea play Fulham twice in the space of 5 fixtures, I think. I could see Fulham win both of those, such as Chelsea's form at the minute. So, as I've mentioned before with other teams, I think being out of the cups is a good thing for Chelsea. It'll give Potter more time on the training pitch to embed these new signings. There's probably more to come, the way Chelsea seems to be doing their business at the minute. So, it's not like Potter's not being backed. I just wonder, is he being backed with players he actually wants, or is it just, here's the next shiny toy?
There's no way. There's no way as well, because, like, there's no way Graham Potter has the time, or even since he's come in, to be able to compile massive reports, long-term planning, all that kind of stuff. It just seems like a disaster. It seems like, and also it seems like their transfer planning, like, is they've got one lad on FIFA and another lad on Twitter checking who everyone else is going for. Like, it does, a lot of it doesn't seem right. It seems like they've got people watching YouTube videos or whatever, and I don't know what convincing Todd Boehly needs to sign a player, but it doesn't seem like much, or it seems like one shred of concrete evidence will do it. And the issue for Chelsea is that this goes way beyond Graham Potter. If this team is untenable with those players getting older, if these new players don't work out, a coach isn't going to be able to fix your problem. You're going to be left with several damp squids. They've already got a couple. You know what I mean? So it's really hard to look at that Chelsea team and see anything positive. I mean, you had the fans chanting Tuchel's name, and I don't know if all of that frustration is being directed at Graham Potter, but at least a chunk of it has to be directed at the ownership. Now, you're not going to be able to change the ownership of your club, right? But
Can I just say, whilst the new ownership have made mistakes in terms of signing Aubameyang, basically.
I didn't even think of that one.
I don't actually... I think the blame is to be laid at, you know, and for a lot of things, obviously, but like the way Abramovich ran that club was insane.
Yeah.
And he has developed his fan base to be such a we buy to win kind of mentality, so that when they go through any period of difficulty, the manager, you know, they won't suffer at all. Like, it's probably the toughest fan base to go through a period of suffering in terms of just poor performance. But at least with the new ownership, you know, they bought Aubameyang in a panic, I think, because they needed a striker. You know, they got rid of Lukaku, but all of the signings they are making are youthful, really promising players. And they're kind of paying out of the nose for them, but in a lot of ways it's working out. And like, I think Potter is the guy to kind of get the best out of that type of team, but it's just that it's not come together because he still has to play, you know, Koulibaly and Thiago Silva, as I mentioned. And also, I'm not sure. I know he seems to prefer Kepa over Mendy, but like, I would say, I'm sure, I wouldn't be shocked if Chelsea were looking at Sanchez or Brighton in the summertime, you know, as a new keeper again, because yeah, the new ownership at least have a strategy that I think is clearly defined and more sustainable, where you buy young players and put them on big contracts so that that cost is amortized over a long period, and then you can also sell them for big chunks if they go really well to Real Madrid or Barcelona or whoever's the big spender, PSG. So
yeah, I think you're right. I think this is a thing of like, Chelsea were never supposed to be at this party, you know what I mean? They got a seat at the table because of their previous ownership and how their ownership operated. I mean, let's face it, they appeared out of nowhere in the mid-2000s because there was only two real teams that were up there battling and challenging. And that, listen, that's not something that I can have a gripe with. It happened, you know what I mean? It happened the way it happened, but what you've got now is a situation where you're trying to go through all these growing pains in the public eye, and that's the difficult thing. If they could do this behind closed doors, they might have a chance. Potter might have a chance. I mean, again, going back to Arteta, I think that's one of the things that he benefited from the most, was he played a lot of these games behind closed doors and was able to sort of, you know, not have the fans on his back for a little while and earn their trust before they even took one step into the stadium. But you mentioned, like, yeah, I don't think the strategy of going for young players is bad. You mentioned Omari Hutchinson. That one sticks in the gut a little bit because, I mean, he could be quite useful right now for Arsenal if he was around. But yeah, they've been driving at academy level as well. I mean, Omari Hutchinson was an academy signing. What, they didn't pay Arsenal any money for that. They managed to snag him without him signing a new professional contract at Arsenal. So they seem to be operating at a basis of they're going to have all this young talent on their books. They want to have an elite coach who's going to be able to turn them into something brilliant. The only thing that I would say about Graham Potter is he doesn't have that in his on his CV, really. Do you know what I mean? He hasn't been at Brighton that long. Obviously, Swansea before that and Östersunds before that. So it's a challenge for him too. But I think if he can keep the faith of the ownership, I think he will improve this Chelsea team, especially after the summer. But yeah, it's going to be
lest we forget how well Brighton were doing before he left.
Of course,
we're like in the Champions League spots, you know, and like, I know it was early season, but anything De Zerbi's doing now strongly benefits from Potter's work. Now, arguably, Potter barely kept Brighton afloat in his first season, if you recall, because he implemented the new style of football as opposed to who's the previous Brighton manager, the Irish international,
Chris Hughton.
But no. They were playing real turgid ball, and Shane Duffy was scoring a lot of headers, you know, like. But maybe, like, this is probably the same thing. Chelsea just suffer now and they finish 10th, and they'll reap the rewards next year when they get Nkunku in and everything else.
I'm just saying, though, like, it takes years, years and years and years to bring a player to the top level of the game consistently. Like, that takes years.
But these, sorry, these are, the, like, your Badiashile and Nkunku, who's arriving in the summer and all of that, like, they're not, like, academy players who need years. They're, like, kind of plug-and-play young players to an extent, in term, but they might just need a year to gel in the system. So if Badiashile is embedded by summer and then you get Nkunku and you embed him throughout the course of next season, like, that's a pretty exciting team all of a sudden. So it's just about patience, and it's something Chelsea fans need to learn. And I hope Potter gets to see it this season and gets all the time in the world with this, because honestly, who else is out there right now? Like, Pochettino, you can't bring Tuchel back. So
I wish Potter no harm, but I wish all the harm on Chelsea. So so I'm enjoying this. I am enjoying this. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't. This is due. Their comeuppance is due, Sean. Would you
say, you know, like, you you used to like Potter, but he's been attributed with some sort of horcrux or something right now?
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like, I even feel a bit ill, like, seeing him in the Chelsea thing, because I'm like, oh, you were supposed to be one of the good ones. Look, he was always gonna go to one of these teams, right? But
Tottenham might have been a better fit.
Maybe, almost certainly, I don't know. But yeah, that wouldn't have made me like him anymore anyway. So, but yeah, no, like, it's interesting to check in and see where everybody's at. But I think over the next couple of weeks, everything's going to unfold. We're going to see at least the title race gain a few more twists and turns. I mean, we will come to it next week, possibly, to talk about how the teams are doing down the lower half of the table. But I guess we kind of had to really dive into things and get our teeth back into things before the league really kicks up steam again. So that's it for this week, I think. I don't think we've anything else to mention. And until then, Shaunie, my friend, I'll see you out there.
I'll see you out there.